Generation Hot.
My daughter is part of Generation Hot, and that's my word for the approximately 2 billion young people around the world who've been born since June 23, 1988, which is the day that NASA scientist Jim Hansen testified to the United States Senate that global warming had begun and threatened very, very serious consequences.
That's Mark Hertzgard talking about HOT, living through the next 50 years on Earth.
Well, as soon as the pollution ceased, then you went back to this, the action that has been going on there for 10,000 years.
And that's Thomas Yuzerski. We talked to him about his picture book for children, Meadowlands. It's the inspiring story about how nature is healing itself in what was one of the most polluted places in America. And we also hear Maxine Kuhlman talking about writing poetry about nature. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. All this month, we're talking with authors about the environment. Instead of Earth Day, we're having Earth Month. We're also squeezing in some poetry where we can, because April is also Poetry Month. First up is Mark Hertzgard. In his book, Hot, he says climate change is here, it's happening, and it's too late to avoid, even if we do everything right on emissions, which, of course, we're not. So we need to start gearing up our efforts to adapt to the changes that are coming. Hertzgard says there's much we can do to adapt, if the political will is there. Example, the 200-year plan to survive climate change being developed by the Netherlands. And they're raising the taxes to pay for it, with the support of their citizens. Of course, in the U.S., the media and politicians act like taxes are theft and government is evil. But some communities, like Seattle and New York, are making strong commitments to adaptation. And elsewhere, even some of the planet's poorest citizens are figuring out how to adapt and spreading their knowledge by word of mouth. Hertzgard explores both the challenges and the possibilities in this terrific book. But more than that, it's a kind of cry of the heart for those, like his young daughter, who are part of Generation Hot.
My daughter is part of Generation Hot, and that's my word for the approximately 2 billion young people around the world who've been born since June 23, 1988, which is the day that NASA scientist Jim Hansen testified to the United States Senate that global warming had begun and threatened very, very serious consequences. And unfortunately, since that time, our government and our corporations and the world in general has done very little to heed that warning. And as a result, the problem has continued and accelerated and intensified to where now we're locked in to at least 50 more years of temperature rise. And so in the book Hot, I'm trying to look at how do we cope with that, not just for my daughter, but for all of the children in Generation Hot. And the surprising thing about it is there, as unfortunate as that news is, there is a lot that we can do to deal with it.
Yeah, and your book is really dedicated to some of the ways that we can adapt to climate change. But before we get to those, you had three, and I'm going to say this word, I'll have to bleep it out, but you had three oh shit moments. What were they?
I think everybody who really finally gets it about climate change has their own, if you will, oh shucks moment, usually a little stronger word than that. And my first one was when I went to China in the mid-90s, and I think I was the first Western writer to go over there and do the environmental story in depth. And I saw how much coal China was burning, and I saw how they had very good reason for burning all that coal, because they had millions and hundreds of millions, really, of very poor people who didn't have enough heat to stay warm in the winter. And you could just see, as I went around the country, the darkened skies and the black coal swirling on the sidewalks, you could just see how much carbon was about to be unleashed into the atmosphere over the years to come as China accelerated its economic development. So that was my first moment where I realized, wow, this problem is going to get a lot worse before it gets better. And then the second moment of that was what gave rise to this book, Hot. And that took place in October 2005 when I was in London on assignment for Vanity Fair. And the British science advisor, British government science advisor, Sir David King, informed me of a paradigm shift that had occurred in this problem, and essentially that global warming had given rise to outright climate change, and it had done so 100 years sooner than expected. And the really fiendish part of that news was that once climate change has been triggered, the inertia of the Earth's climate systems, the laws of physics and chemistry, mean that there's a lag effect between the time that you stop emitting and the time that the temperatures could fall. And Sir David explained that even if the entire world were to stop its greenhouse gas emissions overnight, that nevertheless, the temperatures would not stop increasing on planet Earth for another 30 years. And that's what made me realize that my then very young daughter, who was only 5 months old at that point, was going to be faced with a very, very difficult circumstance. And that's what led me to write the book, Hot.
And your third moment?
Third moment was near the end of writing the book. And that was when I was interviewing, at that time, this was in 2009, I guess, the chief climate advisor to the conservative government of Germany, Chancellor Angela Merkel's top climate advisor named Hans Schellenhuber. And he had done a study with his colleagues in the German government looking at what it would take for humanity to keep the eventual temperature rise to the so-called 2 degrees threshold. That refers to 2 degrees Celsius, which is about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. 2 degrees Celsius above the level that our civilization has existed at for almost all of its 10,000 to 12,000 years. And we're fast approaching that, and the emissions reductions were so massive. You know, the United States would have to basically stop burning oil and coal and gas by the year 2025, 2030 at the outside, unless it did some trading with the other countries. And China as well would have to get off of oil and coal very soon. There was an important caveat to his study, which was that it assumed that the right to emit carbon was shared equally around the world. That's known as the per capita principle. And if you incorporated that per capita principle, which was being insisted upon by the Chinese and many other developing countries, it made for a very, very steep challenge.
Yeah, I think I saw that study, and one that came not too long after that that said that we have 5 more years to decrease emissions if we're to avoid utter catastrophe. When you say 2 to 3 degrees, that sounds like utter catastrophe to me as well.
2 degrees, which is going to be very tough to avoid climbing 2 degrees Celsius, that's going to bring impacts that are plenty difficult enough to deal with. Most of what I look at in the book just looks at 2 degrees. And the impacts of 2 degrees include at least 3 feet of sea level rise, include the fact that by the year 2040, 2050, when my daughter's my age, the terrible summer of 2010, last summer, which people on the east coast of the United States or in Moscow, Russia, and much of Europe will remember as a particularly hot and humid, brutal, record-breaking summer. By 2040, that's going to be a normal summer. It won't necessarily happen every year, but it's going to happen, it'll be every other year. We're going to lose the polar bears off the planet. We're going to lose the coral reefs off the planet. And here in California, where I live, we are going to lose much of the snowpack up in the Sierra Nevada mountains that provides a large portion of our state's fresh water for both drinking water and for agriculture. And California is one of the main agricultural production areas in the world, especially for fruits and nuts and vegetables. So we are already faced with enormous challenges, even if we do everything right on reducing emissions, which we obviously are falling pretty far short of that at the moment.
And reducing emissions is all about mitigation. Your book, Mark Hertzgard, is mostly about adaptation. Explain both terms. What's the difference, and why have some people said that, why has there been a controversy between the two?
Sure. I always like to say that it's very unfortunate, I think, that the initial vocabulary of the climate discussion was created by lawyers and scientists, because they use these terrible, awkward words like mitigation and adaptation that don't really mean much to most people. But at this point, we're probably stuck with them. So mitigation refers to essentially reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and it's what most people think of when they think about fighting global warming. So you burning less coal, switching to solar power, putting up wind turbines, using less oil, and all of that. That's mitigation. You are trying to reduce the amount of emissions that go in the atmosphere that cause global warming and, therefore, climate change. Adaptation is the back end of the problem. Adaptation is dealing with the climate change impacts that are now unavoidable over the coming years. And that refers to putting in place protections against stronger storms, deeper droughts, harsher heat waves. So things like strengthening the levees, which they're doing in the Netherlands and Seattle and King County, Washington, or improving public health systems so that you can deal more appropriately and effectively with heat waves, which they've been doing in Philadelphia and France. And planting trees to help your crops grow better, which they're doing, astonishingly enough, in one of the poorest places in the world, in Western Africa.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with journalist and author Mark Hertzgard about his new book, Hot. It's about adapting to climate change, which is already here and will get worse before it gets better. Hertzgard has written about global warming for The New Yorker, NPR, Time, Vanity Fair, and The Nation. I was in France the year of that brutal heat wave in 2003. I've seen record figures that some 73,000 people died as a result of that.
Yes, at the time, this was there was one story in the American press. The New York Times did a story in August of 2003 that talked about how people were dying so rapidly in Paris that the corpses were piling up outside the morgues. And that story was gave a figure of 15,000 people across Europe that died. Later, when I interviewed Sir David King, the British science advisor, he cited government figures across Europe of 31,000. But we now know, on the basis of a 2008 study commissioned by the European Union of the epidemiology of this, that at least 71,449 excess deaths were registered that summer because of the excess heat. 71,000 people in the space of about 6 to 8 weeks. That is more than the United States lost in the Vietnam War in 6 weeks.
That's phenomenal. So let's look at some of the efforts that you take a look at. Let's look at some cities in the U.S. How about where you are first? You live near San Francisco. You don't live in the city, but you live near it.
I do live in the city now. I moved since I finished the book.
Oh, okay. And your wife is actually a commissioner with the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, so she's got some expertise on these issues as well. How vulnerable is San Francisco?
Well, not just San Francisco, but all of California is going to be quite, we're going to face a challenge. There's no getting around it. Two things. The 3 feet of sea level rise is going to create enormous difficulty for us. It's going to put the two main airports in the San Francisco Bay Area underwater, San Francisco Airport and Oakland Airport. Not just the runways, but in the case of San Francisco, also the highways that get you to the airport are going to be underwater at 3 feet. 3 feet of sea level rise would also basically submerge the city's main beach, so Ocean Beach, which is the beach is just south of the Golden Gate Bridge. Probably the single greatest threat, though, to California is, again, water. The fact that we're going to lose, the rising temperatures are going to melt the snowpack on top of the Sierra Nevada mountains that separate California from Nevada and provide a lot of our water. And there's just nothing that we can do to prevent that at this point. You know, with the airports, probably what will end up happening eventually is that they'll build seawalls around those airports. With the snowpack, I've yet to find anybody who can think of a way to prevent that snowpack from melting. There are things you can do to deal with the consequences of that, and there'll be two. There'll be stronger floods and, at the same time, greater water shortages. And that sounds paradoxical, but essentially what will happen is that the warming temperatures will mean that the snowpack melts sooner in the year than it should. It will start melting in the late winter and early spring, and the flow of water down into the lowlands will be much stronger, and therefore there will be increased risk of deadly flooding. At the same time, because we're going to be that water will be melting earlier, there will be less of it available in late spring and summer, and especially late summer, when, of course, human beings and animals and plants and everything else that relies on water, that's when we need it, is in the summer, and we're going to have less of it. So that's probably the single greatest challenge that this state faces.
And how do you think that, how can the state adapt to that?
As I say, I think with the sea level rise, there's going to be places that you will put seawalls around, and then other places we're going to have to abandon. And that is a very, very controversial idea, but there's no getting around it. Because we waited too long to get on top of this problem, we're not going to be able to save every place that we'd like or every one that we'd like.
Talk about that kind of triage. You go pretty deeply into the example of Holland, a country that I'm very familiar with because my father was Dutch. And, you know, in fact, I have a friend whose son works on the dikes, and he talks about the fact that, you know, the Dutch are thinking they're just going to have to abandon certain parts of the country. On the other hand, they have a 200-year plan to survive climate change. So tell us a little bit about this example and how do they deal with the issue of this kind of triage, the areas to save, the areas to let go.
Yes, it is remarkable that the Dutch have this 200-year plan to adapt to climate change. And when I first wrote that in an early draft of the book, my editor, when he sent back the manuscript with his comments, he circled it and said, circled the word, the number 200, and said in the margin, typo. And I sent it back and said, not a typo. Because it's just so inconceivable to an American that any country could plan 200 years out. We didn't even plan 20 years out for the most part. So, and one of the things that they say about that is that, look, we are Dutch, and we know that if you looked at our country from the standpoint of Europe, you might say, okay, let's not bother to try to defend the Netherlands. It's too far away. It's going to be too costly to do it. They're too low-lying. But we are Dutch, and we want to keep this land, and we've been here for 800 years, and we are going to work this problem. And they are working that problem. They're spending a lot of money at it, about $1.5 billion a year. And what is perhaps more impressive even than that is that they are making very tough-minded decisions, including, as your question references, moving people out of areas that cannot be defended. And that includes a couple of stories I write about in Hot, a case where there was a guy who had a plan to develop a resort along the coast. And they had a lot of meetings about it, and essentially the decision was finally made, no, you're not going to be able to do that. It is just too dangerous and too expensive to defend that area, and we will compensate you, but you will not be able to build on that land. And they ended up building instead, the government will be building stronger sea defenses there, and then behind those defenses, they will give the same businessman an area that will be a fishing resort and wetlands area. And he will be invited to do that, which obviously was not his first choice. But the Dutch are fairly tough-minded about all this. And I think it's going to... part of the reason they can do that is that they have 800 years of experience dealing with these issues, and they have a population that essentially trusts in the process, that a population that is willing to pay taxes and believes that the government will spend those taxes wisely to defend them against sea level rise and storms and so forth. That's an enormous advantage.
Yeah, actually, you talk a lot in the book Hot, Mark Hertzgaard, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, about what you call the social context. And you point out that, you know, we have here in this country an ideology that government is evil, that taxes are theft, and regulation is unneeded. And you say that this is just a terrible mistake when it comes to adaptation. Talk about New Orleans and what, you know, what does the social context do for the survival of New Orleans?
Yes, the social context is so vital. I would just take issue with one small part of what you said. I think there is a loud minority in the United States that thinks that taxes are evil and government is wrong. And they sound like they're bigger than they are because they have a megaphone in the form of a right-wing media machine, Fox TV and so forth. But there's plenty of other Americans who are willing to be grown-ups and to recognize that if you want to live in a civilized society, taxes is part of what you do, part of the price you pay. You pay taxes in order to have police protection. You pay taxes in order to have schools and highways and federal aviation systems that don't let planes crash out of the sky, not to mention military and so forth. So, and in fact, I'll get to New Orleans in a second, but just to set up the contrast, one of the great success stories in this country in terms of coping with climate change is up in Seattle, King County, Washington, where they're strengthening their levees and so forth, and they are taxing themselves to do it. And the county executive who pushed that through got reelected 3 times. How did he do that, despite raising taxes? He did it by going to the people and explaining why the taxes had to be raised, that if they didn't strengthen these levees and they're against these greater floods of climate change, they could lose $46 million a day out of their economy. And he did that, by the way, before New Orleans gave us such tragic affirmation of that point. New Orleans lost 1,800 people, many, many hundreds of thousands of people whose lives were disrupted, $200 billion in economic losses from Hurricane Katrina. And that was largely because the government there was shoddy, was not on the case. The levees were poorly constructed, terribly maintained, and Louisiana did not have a building code before Hurricane Katrina. Why? Because building codes were disparaged as, oh, that's socialism, that's government planning, that's control, that's not what we want. That ideology, which is quite rampant in many parts of the United States, including the new Republican majority in Congress, that ideology is not going to serve us well in the years to come if you want to survive against climate impacts. You've got to be able to work together, and workable government, effective government, responsible government is an essential part of that.
In fact, you say that, you know, the cost of not adapting to climate change, the cost of not mitigating climate change could reach 25% of GNP. What about the cost of adapting?
Yeah, it's not me who says that. That's a United States government figure of 25%. Yeah, the cost of not adapting is the... That's really expensive, you know. And again, New Orleans shows proves the point. They were not ready for even a Category 3 hurricane, and they ended up almost losing New Orleans and terrible human suffering and economic destruction. How are we going to deal with the amount of climate impacts that are now unavoidable? What's already locked in, as we've mentioned, 3 feet of sea level rise, the increase of temperatures, the stronger storms and the droughts, that's going to be very tough, for example, for Phoenix in the southwest of the United States, going to be very, very tough to keep large population centers there, even if we limit the climate change to the current amount. If it gets higher than that, if suddenly we're looking at not just 2 degrees Celsius of temperature rise, but 4 degrees, which we could have easily within 50 years if we don't change our trajectory on emissions, that then you reach a point where you probably can't adapt. You know, adaptation is important, but even the strongest advocates for adaptation say, one scientist in the book says, look, if somebody gave me $1 to spend on either adaptation or mitigation, I'd spend $2.50 on the mitigation, on reducing the emissions to turn down the temperature rise. Because it doesn't take long for you to, if you think about this, it's pretty apparent pretty quickly that beyond a certain point, we can't adapt. We're not going to be able to adapt to 20 feet of sea level rise. That's going to essentially spell the end of civilization. So we've absolutely got to turn down emissions and switch to a green economy as rapidly as possible.
Some people say we don't really know enough about how climate change will affect us, so we shouldn't worry about it yet. Mark Hertzgard says they've got it all wrong.
That's fairly foolish because, as we've learned on this problem, just because you don't know, it doesn't mean it's going to be better than you think. It can also be worse than you think.
And so far it has. And in fact, you draw the analogy to insurance. I mean, we buy auto insurance not because we've had an accident, but in case we do have an accident. And talking about insurance, tell us about the insurance industry and their response to this, because they seem to be the one industry that does seem to be aware of the need for adaptation.
Yes, parts of the insurance industry are aware, I would say. Not all of the insurance industry. Because if they were all aware, they would be changing how they invest. And you know, the insurance industry is about the biggest investment capital block in the world economy. And most of their investment is still going towards fossil fuels that make the problem worse. But in terms of the adaptation side, the impact side, there are a lot of insurance companies, less so in the United States, certainly overseas. Most of the insurance companies now recognize that climate change is bad news for them. It's going to bring stronger storms and lots of other extreme weather events that will basically cause them to pay out a lot in damages. So I think that's to the good. And if it's to the good that the insurance companies recognize that, and if the insurance companies can use their leverage with other corporations on this, I think to get them not just to put in place protections, but to shift to a green economy as soon as possible, that could be decisive because the insurance industry has such strong leverage within the world economy.
Mm-hmm. In the time we have left, and I know, regrettably, our time is short here, is to talk about the example of New York. You actually say that you might advise your daughter when she grows up to move to New York. Why?
The reason for saying that about New York is that New York is one of the few places in the United States that recognizes this problem and that is working the problem. They haven't done as much yet as they need to, and I'm talking about New York City, not New York State here. But it is certainly all to the good that the local government is so focused and is working together with private industry and local scientists. They've set up their own version of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in New York to study what the impacts will be on the New York area, and then to tell, for example, the airports and the subway system and the Port Authority and all of the major infrastructure players there and the private sector people, look, here's what you need to get prepared for. We expect X number of super storms by the year 2025. We expect double the amount of over 90 degree temperature days in the summer by 2020. And they are getting the bureaucracies in both the public and private sectors to begin working this problem. And that is critical. Most of the United States is still in denial about this part of the problem. You know, I've also said in the book that I consider advising my daughter to go live in the Netherlands, even though most of the country is 15 feet below sea level. Why? Because they're working the problem, and they're working it very expertly.
And finally, you have a very inspiring story, as you you referred to in the beginning of this, at the top of this interview, a story that takes place in one of the poorest countries in Africa of the ways that people are adapting to climate change. Tell us that story about the trees in the cropland.
Yeah, that, I'm so glad I came across that story because, you know, it's certainly very easy to get downhearted on this topic. And what gives me hope is looking at a story like in West Africa that you mentioned, where some of the poorest people in the world, illiterate farmers in Mali and Burkina Faso and Niger, are adapting to climate change, even though most of them do not know the term. They are experiencing it, but they don't know the term. And the way that they are adapting to the much higher temperatures there and growing drought is by growing trees in the midst of their fields of millet and sorghum. Not planting the trees, growing them. They do not. These farmers do not have enough money to plant trees. They can't buy the seedlings. They can't keep them alive with irrigation systems because they don't can't afford irrigation systems. What they do is they dig little pits. They call them zai, about the size of a, say, a round version of a baseball home plate. And they make a little hollow there, and they put cow and animal manure in there, and thus when the water, what little rainfall comes, it goes down in there, and that manure has seeds in it from trees, and those that therefore sprouts bushes and trees. And those trees provide shade in the field that help the plants to grow, but more important, their roots go down into the earth, and they aerate the underground soil so that when the rain falls, the rain doesn't just flash off onto the creeks and disappear. The rain soaks down into the ground. And the results have just been unbelievable. I'm not sure I would have believed if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes. The underground water tables are rising. The productivity of the croplands is doubling and tripling. And most gratifyingly, the incidence of child malnutrition in these areas is plummeting. And this is a practice, this so-called regreening of Africa through growing trees. This has been done by the poorest people in the world without a lot of international funding. And they are spreading the idea themselves from farmer to farmer and village to village. It has spread over such a vast area in Western Africa that it is literally, literally, you can see it from outer space in satellite pictures taken by the U.S. government. So I think that's an enormously encouraging story. If people like that, who have so little, can do so much, surely the rest of us can do our part.
Mark Hertzgard, your book, and we just barely touched the surface of it. It's really a wonderful, wonderful book. It's Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And I think this example that you give is also an example of a principle you talk about in the book, and that is that it's the species that do adapt that will survive.
I couldn't agree more. Thanks so much for having me.
Go to writersvoice.net for links to Hertzgard's blog. He's got a post there about the climate cranks in Congress and the damage they're doing to our ability to adapt. Next up, we talk with children's book author and illustrator Thomas Yuzerski about the New Jersey Meadowlands and their returning wildlife. Stay tuned.
Can you call on your imagination as if telling a myth to a child? Put in the fantastical, wonderful, magical, and the romantic, the brave, and the wild. Once upon a time there was a power so great that no one could know its name. People tried to claim it and rule with it, all with such arrogance and it in shame. Thousands of years would pass in a moment, hundreds of cultures would come and go, each generation with a glorious calling, even when they were too busy to know. And then one day, after two millennia, which after all was a small part of time, hundreds of souls found their way out of nowhere to be on Earth at the threat of decline.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Thomas Yuzerski's beautiful picture book for young children, Meadowlands, recounts the astonishing return of wildlife to one of the most polluted landscapes in America. Set where the Hackensack River meets the Newark Bay, it describes a place that once was of pristine beauty, what happened to destroy that beauty, and how it is now coming back. Once, white cedar forests and marshlands nurtured an abundance of marine and land animals. But by the time I came to know it as a child growing up in northern New Jersey, it was a wasteland poisoned by countless chemical plants and oil refineries. But something magical happened after I moved away. Using the Clean Air Act, which is currently under fierce attack in the U.S. Congress, the state and regional governments were able to stop the toxic dumping, and the insects, fish, birds, and other animals returned. In Meadowlands, Yezierski shows the web of life being rewoven, strand by strand. It's a hopeful vision, one to cradle in the mind as we gird ourselves for the challenges of the future. Thomas Yezierski, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm so pleased to be here.
Now, what is the Meadowlands? Tell our listeners, what is the Meadowlands? Where is it?
Well, the Meadowlands is an estuary where the Hackensack River meets Newark Bay. The Meadowlands term came about, it's almost a real estate term, because it was named that, I think, around the time when they started wanting to develop the area for housing and real estate and shopping and things like that. So it's more of a commercial district, but it does still include the estuary. And so I think of it as more of the natural area, biologic area.
And so how did you come to decide to do a book about this?
You know, it kind of happened organically. I grew up in Pennsylvania and moved to Rutherford, New Jersey in 1995. And it seemed like every time I was going out to go shopping or to get to my friend's house or something, I was always getting lost in the Meadowlands. Because anyone who has been through the area, you have the biggest highway is obviously the New Jersey Turnpike running north to south. And you have Route 80, which is at the north end, and the Belleville Turnpike, which is down at the south end. So you have these crisscrossing highways, and I was always getting lost. And I would often end up in these very strange, fantastical, scary places near abandoned factories and warehouses and things like that. And it was very confusing. And so by looking at maps and trying to figure out what was going on there and trying to make sense of it, I became very curious about it. And, then I was finding out more and more about the history, the Superfund sites that are there that are very heavily polluted and no one has enough money to clean them up. And then I found out about the animals and started seeing the birds. And so my curiosity became a fascination and a love for it. And then little by little, the story started coming out of it with this resurgence of the creatures that had lived there thousands of years ago and had started coming back. And I thought that was a great idea for a kid's story.
It is. It's a wonderful book. Now, you've also done the illustrations as well. Is that right?
That's right. I did the illustrations for it, too. I'm an illustrator by trade. But when I was coming out of college and wanting to publish my children's illustrations, editors were telling me that I should write something myself, and that would get me a better chance of having my illustrations published.
Well, it's a wonderful combination in this book, Meadowlands, Thomas Yezierski. You know, I did a little field testing of this book the other day. I read it to my granddaughter, and she was fascinated not only by the story itself, but by the illustrations around the borders of each page. Tell us what you do with that.
Well, in this book, there are 16 spreads, or maybe 18, I'm not sure exactly how many. And then around the borders of each of the spreads, I have 20 small spot illustrations. And so as I'm telling the story, there's a main idea with each spread be it the insects that are in the meadowlands or the plants that are in the meadowlands or the shorebirds that live in the meadowlands. And I wanted to show in the main picture a very natural-looking scene that showed one of those creatures doing whatever it does without doing the kind of the old, the more traditional cliched way of showing a book of, you know, say the rainforest and showing every creature of the rainforest in one sort of unnatural peaceable kingdoms kind of picture. So, but I was so struck with, or so taken with all the different creatures and all the biodiversity of this place that I wanted to show everything. So in order to do that, I put the pictures of all the other little creatures around the borders. So say on the picture of the dragonfly, I also show the coffee bean snail and the whirligig and all kinds of other interesting insects that live there.
Yes, you do. Now, you also show all some of the not-so-nice things, because this is a history of the Meadowlands, kind of of its pristine originality, and then its decline, and then some of its resurgence. I have to say I was really fascinated by this, because I used to live in New Jersey when I grew up in New Jersey, and we used to go on Route 80 to New York. We used to go, actually, we used to go down to 46, is that right, and down to the Lincoln Tunnel. And we used to pass by this area. I don't remember it being called the Meadowlands at that time, so I'm sure it was pre that name. And it was horrible. It was just the stench of the chemical industries and the oil refineries. It was just a devastated landscape. And I can even remember as a child thinking, oh, I wish I could have been here to see it the way it was originally. It must have been beautiful. What was it like when the Indians lived here? So tell us, what was it like?
Nobody's really sure, because the first Europeans to come here in 1609 didn't keep a lot of records. They were here to exploit the land, quite honestly. And so they didn't write about it very much. There is some writing about Manhattan, which was a similar area. And so I think a lot of us get our picture of the Meadowlands from stories of New York, actually. But at one time, apparently, it was mostly white cedar swamps. Mm-hmm. So shallow water with this forest of trees growing out of it. And a lot of the Dutch farmers who came and settled, they would cut down the trees and they used the land along the edges of the estuary for farming, huge plantation-style farms. So it was a wide, grassy area and a typical estuary, probably like you would see the Chesapeake Bay area, really wide expanses of wet land. And even today, if you go out in the canoe and you find the right spot, you know, where you can find a place where you don't see any sign of human settlement there, and you can get a little glimpse of what it was like back in the 16th century.
And you've done that.
I have, yeah. Like I said, it started out with getting lost in the car, and then eventually I had enough courage to get out and walk under the turnpike, and then after that, I even got a canoe and went out a few times to paddle up close to some of those super fun sites or amongst the reeds. And that is an amazing experience, because these reeds, the Phragmites, which is the predominant species of plant there, they grow, they're over 6 feet high. And when you're low down in the canoe, you can paddle along some of these streams and not see anything but reeds, and it's a great experience. And you don't hear anything either. They're a great buffer. You don't hear traffic or anything like that.
The nature of the estuary, where you have the salt water coming in and the fresh water coming down, that's a very special environment that's had something to do with the resilience of this place, its resurgence. Tell us how it got from where it was when I knew it to some of the recovery that's going on today.
Well, that's the crux of this story, and it's amazing, and it's very encouraging that nature can do this. humans have been fighting nature ever since they started settling there. They wanted to get rid of the mosquitoes, and then they wanted to drain the water out so they could dry the land for farming. But nature didn't give up that easily. So around the time when the state of New Jersey created the Hackensack Meadowlands Development Commission, they wanted to clean the area up, basically, so that they could put in things like Giant Stadium. Mm-hmm. And they stopped, little by little, the dumping in the landfill. It started with not issuing any new landfill dumping permits. And then one by one, they closed, I think there were 30 landfills at one time. They closed them down. With the Clean Water Act, they stopped factories from dumping in the Meadowlands. And so as soon as the pollution ceased, then you went back to this, the action that has been going on there for 10,000 years, which is you have the river flowing southward, the Hackensack River, and then twice a day, the Newark Bay from the Atlantic Ocean, the tide rises up and meets that river current. So it pushes back, and by pushing back and the river pushing one way and the current, the tide pushing the other way, it creates this kind of washing machine motion. And so all the debris that the river is carrying and the plankton and other things that the tide is carrying, it falls down to the bottom of the riverbed and creates this very rich mud, which covers over a lot of the pollutants and also creates, continually recreates itself to provide a nursery for fish and insects and all the things that nature needs at the bottom of the food chain to grow. And then before you know it, the birds that have been flying over this way on the Atlantic Flyway, they were hungry when they passed by here, and they looked down, and eventually they saw there was enough to eat, and they started landing again. And now they're breeding their own families there, too.
Many of these chemicals that were there, the pollutants, as you say, the Superfund sites that still haven't been cleaned up, I mean, these are toxic chemicals of long, long duration, PCBs, dioxins. You know, you actually list them. You've got pictures of them in the book, hexavalent chromium. I mean, these are horrible carcinogens, and they last a long time. How come this area is able to be clean enough to support this abundance of wildlife that you're talking about?
Well, I should say that in the areas that are most polluted, nothing is still living there. You have one of the most mercury, the highest concentrations of mercury in a freshwater water body. As a matter of fact, they post signs, you know, don't crab here, because the blue crabs can live there, but you can't eat those crabs because they have a high concentration of poison in there. And other areas are less polluted. And like I said, the muck that continues to pile up covers over a lot of that pollution at the bottom of the riverbed. But also the plants, the grasses and reeds, they filter out a lot of that pollution. Now, the pollution is still there. It's in the grasses and reeds, mm-hmm. but it comes out of the water. And then enough oxygen can be in the water to support fish populations and insects and things like that.
Wow. Thomas Yuzerski, you've written this book, Meadowlands, A Wetland Survival Story. It's really a story of hope, I found. I mean, one of the few little points of light that one can find in when thinking about what's going on with the environment. This is a picture book. This is for kids, I guess, between, say, 4 and 9 or 10.
5 and 8 is what how the publisher said it, yeah.
Of course, I totally enjoyed it, and I'm many decades older than that. What do you hope that this will do for kids?
I think the thing I wanted kids to see the most was how humans are a part of nature. Nature isn't something to be walked through and enjoyed and kept like a pet. By seeing the biodiversity in this place that has, been relegated to a wasteland by so many people, I think kids can see how humans and nature live together. And I think kids need to see, and all people, we all need to see that whatever we do in these natural places, it's like it's all like part of one body, you know. Just because you know you have some kind of sickness in some part of your body, you don't cut out that part of your body. You have to make the whole thing healthy. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that's the message that everybody gets.
How long did it take you to actually write this book?
Well, I'm kind of embarrassed to say because it's a picture book, but it took me 10 years. It took me years to work through research and taking notes. And because this was my first nonfiction, I didn't have a system down. So I was finding more and more research and finding out more and more that I didn't know about the subject and just not knowing where to stop with the research. So then eventually I just had to say, that's enough. Now I have to figure out how to make this book. But then a picture book is only 32 pages, and I'm not sure how many words, but it's very little. And I had probably had hundreds of thousands of words that I had to cut down into maybe 500 words. So I had to distill all this information into a story that not only was short, but also that was translatable to kids.
And how did you boil that down? I mean, was this how did you make that process of distillation work for you?
Well, I kind of went back to an old trick that I use as an illustrator, which is I distill everything down into one word. And what is that one word? And for this story, it was revitalization. It was the comeback, you know. And so everything that you do has to serve that one word. And if it doesn't, even if it's fascinating, it has to go, which is sad. I could probably write 10 other books about this subject because of all the other things going on. But just in order to get something done and out there, that's what you have to do.
Now, before this, you had just written fiction books. That's what you're saying?
Right. I had, there's always an educational aspect to my books because it's almost like I feel like that is the surest way that I'll get it published because there's something in it that is of value to somebody. If it's just fiction, something that I've made up, I don't have the confidence to think that other people will be interested. So my other stories have been based on family history, things that I feel like I know about that not a lot of people know about. And in this case, I kind of broke that old rule of write about what you know. And I know why that rule is in place now, because it makes it really hard if you don't do it that way. So I was writing about something I didn't know, something I wanted to learn more about. But of course, that makes it difficult because you don't know where the thing is going to end.
And so you say you distilled it down to one word. Was that before you began writing this, or when you began writing this, did you know what this was about?
No, I didn't know what it was about. I think the first thing that I thought it should be about was people's misperceptions of what the Meadowlands is. I wanted to look at it from a New Yorker's point of perspective. And actually, that's still in there a little bit because the first page is a view of the Meadowlands from the Empire State Building. Because coming from Pennsylvania, even, we grew up with a prejudice against New Jersey. You know, it stinks, it's ugly, all these things. And so when I learned differently, as people who moved to New Jersey do, I thought that was funny that I thought that. And I wanted to show how things in the Meadowlands really aren't what you thought. But that wasn't really enough to drive the whole story. So, when I learned about the way all these creatures were coming back and surviving there, that's when I realized that's what the real story was.
Well, Thomas Yuzerski, the book is Meadowlands, a wetland survival story. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Well, we've just a little time left on today's show. Time enough to bring you a clip from an interview I did with poet Maxine Cumin. One of America's best-known poets, Cumin lives in rural New England on a working farm. Her love of nature and her anguish at what humans are doing to it is a major theme of her work. In this clip, I talk with her about that theme and about her poetry volume, Nurture. Your poetry looks full face on some very difficult and painful things. There are the themes in your poetry, I mean, the beautiful connection. The connection to the natural world is one that brings both great joy and great pain, considering the state of the natural world these days.
Right.
And a lot of your poetry, for example, in Nurture, the poem Nurture, as well as in the poetry volume Nurture, you take up the theme of what is going on with the planet, how animals are being destroyed, how species are being destroyed. This is something that pains me whenever I read or listen to a report on the radio or something that talks about the death of a species. I feel it viscerally.
Yes, I agree. So do I.
And often it's too painful for me to really remain there. I switch to another channel. I turn to a different page. But when I read the poems in Nurture, I was able to look full face at this through the medium of your poetry. And I wonder if you could talk about that. In what way can poetry enable us to contemplate the horror in a way that doesn't destroy us?
Well, it's a delicate balance between, you know, writing a polemic and writing a poem. How it operates upon the individual, I think it has to operate artistically. In other words, it has to be a good poem. Then it can convey a message. And I've been particularly taken with this kind of difficulty of bringing the two together. Anything that goes beyond the simply lyrical has to engage with the world as it is. And I guess Nurture is one poem that does.
I'd love to have you read that poem then.
Okay. Nurture. From a documentary on marsupials, I learned that a pillowcase makes a fine substitute pouch for an orphaned kangaroo. I am drawn to such dramas of animal rescue. They are warm in the throat. I suffer, the critic proclaims, from an overabundance of maternal genes. Bring me your fallen fledgling, your bummer lamb. Lead the abused, the starvelings, into my barn. Advise the hunted deer to leap into my corn. And had there been a wild child, filthy and fierce as a ferret, he is called in one 19th century account, a wild child to love, it is safe to assume, given my fireside inked with paw prints, there would have been room. Think of the language we two, same and not same, might have constructed from sign, scratch, grimace, grunt, vowel, laughter, our first noun, and our long verb, howl.
Maxine Cumin reading the poem Nurture. If you want to read it for yourself, you can find a link to the poem at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests and see videos or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.